Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. It's podcast day. This is the Leading LDS Podcast. I'm your host, Kurt Frankum. And one thing you may not know about me is I was a Deseret newspaper boy for 3 years as a youth, and I can hit any porch from about 30 yards. I'm just saying. But I digress. And this episode is a How I Lead segment where we go out and find the most interesting, most dynamic everyday leaders who wouldn't proclaim themselves as a leadership expert, but as we talk with them and they share their principles that they learned as serving or that they applied serving, we learn quite a bit. And today we're talking with Steve Russell from Lehi, Utah. And this episode came from a good person, Pamela, who connected us and suggested that I interview Steve. And so if you know of somebody who I should definitely interview, who's got great ideas, who's a great leader, who inspired you, whatever it is, reach out to me at leadinglds.org/contact, and I would love to reach out to them. So in this episode, Steve talks about his conversion story. That takes up a good amount of time in the beginning, and it's quite interesting and inspiring to see how he was converted and joined the church and later served a mission. And then we talk about his time serving as a bishop in Tooele, Utah, and he shares his five principles and good stuff. Even talks about how he started an orchestra in his ward. So here is my interview with Steve Russell. And to Utah County, we are headed to Lehi, Utah to talk with Steve Russell. How are you, Steve?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. Now, how long have you lived there in Lehi?
Oh, just since July of last year.
Okay. And you like the Utah County vibe?
Yeah, you know, we just moved from Grantsville, which is a very small town.
Yeah.
And it is different to be in a place that is so heavily populated. We have a Home Depot across from Lowe's, right? Whereas in Grantsville, we had, I think, 2.5 restaurants. So,
it's, wow.
You know, you have a lot of convenience here, but you pay for it because there are people everywhere.
I bet. Yeah, that's for sure. And you are, the reason this interview came to be is, we'll give a shout out to Pamela, who connected us and recommended that I reach out to you and set up this interview. And so anybody else listening, if you know a dynamic leader or somebody that has inspired you, I'd love to hear from you, and we can set up an interview much like this. So, Steve, just to put you into context and get to know you better, I'm just going to fire some rapid-fire questions at you, and your responses do not have to be rapid, but the questions are. So, where were you raised?
Southern California, Fullerton,
nice.
Anaheim, that area.
Very nice. And you now live in Lehi, and when did you get baptized?
I was 22, so 1982.
Wow. So tell us, how did that come to be?
Well, you want the long version or the short version?
We got all day, Steve, as long as you... No, I mean, I think it's inspiring to hear these stories, especially of leaders. So,
okay, well, I was working as a musician, so I worked at nights and, you know, did some writing and other things during the day, but I had a lot of free time during the day. And one day I was watching a television program. It's an old show called Firing Line, Bill Buckley. He was hosting the show, and he was interviewing a guy named Mortimer J. Adler. Mr. Adler had edited the great books of the Western world and the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he'd written a book called How Men Are Like Angels. And I was watching this program, and Mr. Adler was talking about God in a way that I was really unfamiliar with. He was very rational, calm. He wasn't pounding the pulpit. He wasn't all sweetness and light like some other preachers who don't want to address difficult topics either. So I was really fascinated by what he was saying. So I decided I would go to the library and see what he had written. And I checked out a few of his books. And as I'm reading through his books, I also checked the bibliography to see what he'd been reading. And he was reading things by people who'd been dead for a very long time. And Plato, Aristotle, Montaigne, Voltaire. So I started reading that stuff too. So, you know, in your mind, you've got this single guy who's a jazz musician spending all day reading the classics. And that, after doing that for several months, the missionaries knocked on my door. So I was tracked it out by Elder Matekel and Elder Christensen. Elder Christensen was due to leave in just a few weeks, but he sort of took the lead and, you know, stepped into my apartment. I invited him in, and And he looked around and saw a lot of books, and he said, "Hey, do you like history?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Have you ever heard of Quetzalcoatl?" And I had. And he said, "We believe that was Christ visiting the Americas, and we've got a book about his visit and his ministry and the people that lived here. Would you like to read it?" And of course, that's what I do. I read books all day, right? So they came at the right time. So I made an appointment to see them again the next week and began reading. And I remember reading the first page and thinking, this is different. This is not somebody's opinion. This is not a philosophical work. This is a historical account, and it's either true or it's not. And so I started reading it with the intent to try to figure out if it made sense, if it was true. And I read through about Alma by Thursday of the following week, and had a list of a bunch of questions. And you know, over the course of a few discussions, one of the questions I asked was, you know, you guys say that Heavenly Father, Christ, and the Holy Ghost are three different people, persons, and yet Abinadi says they're the same guy. How is that? And this is Abinadi 15:1. And Elder Matikel said, well, you know, first they tried to explain it to me, and they didn't take me to some scriptures I now might have clarified it. And after a bit of frustration, I think Elder Matikel said, "Well, I don't know, you're just going to have to pray about it," which, looking back, was a funny thing. He said exactly the right thing, right? So, and fortunately, he didn't know enough to direct me to all of the logical scriptural passages. So after I had finished the Book of Mormon, read the Doctrine and Covenants, and had several discussions, and I went to a meeting, and I remember one of the sisters in the ward came up to the podium and bore her testimony, and she said she knew. And I thought to myself, how does she know? What happened in her life that makes her so certain? And what does she mean by knowing? Remember, I'm reading all this philosophy about, how do you know if you know what you know, right?
Right, yeah.
And so I'm
deep
really
stuff.
Lost. I'm really lost in the weeds when it comes to philosophy. And and so I'm trying to, imagining in my mind how she, and, you know, most members of the church, when they bear their testimony, they'll say they know, but they won't point to an event. It is, as Elder Bednar explained, a little bit like dawn approaching. You know, at some point it's day, but you don't know when that happened.
Right.
Most members of the church, they know in that manner. So they can't say, let me tell you what happened. And so I didn't know how she knew, but the missionaries were encouraging me to pray. And so one night after work, I got home quite late, as I usually did, and put my gear away, and I decided I'm going to go ahead and pray. And I'd never prayed vocally before. And so I knelt by my bed, and I said, God, help me to know if what the mission, as soon as I started to say the word missionaries, my thoughts were interrupted with an overwhelming feeling of peace and joy. It was so pronounced that I couldn't speak. And I felt as though the room was full of light. You know, you get that feeling sometimes through your eyelids that maybe the light is on. And but I didn't want to open my eyes because I was concerned that the feeling would stop. It was so awesome, you know. And this was before computers, and I used to say it was like someone had taken a needle and injected my brain with the knowledge that everything was true that I'd been taught. I now say it was more like a very quick download, right, or an upload to my brain.
Yeah.
And so as I knelt there and I had this amazing feeling, I just knew. It was the strangest thing. And then it started to dissipate, and I opened my eyes and I was alone. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. So the next morning, I remember thinking about the things in my life that would change. It was though I was already there. There was no wondering about what I would do next. It was just obvious. And fortunately, you know, even as a jazz musician, I didn't drink. You know, occasionally I would have a drink if somebody bought the band a round of drinks where I was working. I would, you know, get something with orange juice in it. I didn't enjoy drinking. I didn't think it tasted very good. And I think I could count on one hand, maybe three times in my life where I'd been intoxicated because of alcohol. It was usually something stupid. I remember when I was eight, my dad took me, you know, to a friend's house who was Jewish so we could see what a bar mitzvah was like. And after every paragraph, we were supposed to take a little sip of this wine, and being eight, I took too much and got sick on the way home in the car and lost all my bar mitzvah meal out on the road there. So that's a good example of, you know, my experiences with alcohol growing up.
Yeah.
I didn't use drugs, which was very strange for a jazz musician. I remember a lot of fellow musicians would say, you know, Steve, you know, reality is for people who can't handle drugs, you know, and I would think to myself, you know, jazz is hard. Why would anybody want to try to do it with fewer brain cells, you know? And so I didn't really have any issues with that. And so I thought about the things that would change my life, and it really wasn't that much. And the missionaries never asked me to be baptized. They, one day I remember Elder Christensen was gone. Elder Levin showed up and for a discussion, he said, hey, there's a young woman getting baptized this Saturday. I thought you might like to come and see what it's like. And I said, sure. So I went and watched the, you know, the baptism. And then he said, what'd you think? And I said, well, let's do it. And he about fell over. He said, really? I think they were afraid if they pushed too hard, I might go away or something. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that's how I came to know. And I can point to a moment in my life, and I remember it very clearly, when I was told that this is real, this is true, this is where I need to be. And over the years, I've wondered why it is that people learn in so many different kinds of ways. You know, my experience, I've met people who've had a similar experience, right? But the vast majority of people who get a whisper here and there, and I've come to respect that greatly, the idea that somebody can get just a whisper now and then, that they don't have this, you know, big event in their life where they can point to it and say, okay, I know, because I remember, right? All they have are these whispers now, and yet they are so good. You know, they keep coming. They keep serving despite the challenges and the trials. And I think, boy, these are some great people. This is all they need is a whisper now and then. And they're on the straight and narrow. Some of us apparently need something more dramatic. Anyway, so that's how I came to know. And then a year later, I went on a mission to Bolivia. And while there, met my wife, who was a welfare missionary in her last area. I was her district leader. She's from Logan, Utah. I met her and started writing her when she went home. I'm 2 months older than she was. Remember, I'm a little older when I joined the church, and I'm so we're both 24. And so we wrote, and then I got back and we got married, and we have 8 kids, and I ended up going to BYU Law School and leaving the music profession. And so now I have a practice in Salt Lake.
With your mission, was that a natural step for you? Something that you looked forward to from the moment you were baptized, or was that its own process?
You know, that's an interesting question. I remember I asked about that right after I joined the church. I asked the missionaries about who goes on missions. And one of them said, well, only about a third of the young men go, and you're older, you have your career, so nobody really expects you to go. And I took that as meaning, don't bother asking, right? Yeah. And so I sort of put it out of my mind. And one day, my bishop, who knew that I like to learn things, I joined the church at 22, and I thought I was woefully behind. And so I'm reading everything I can get my hands on to try to catch up, you know, even Hugh Nibley, right? I'm reading all this stuff. And so the bishop one day, he says, there's a brother in our ward that's teaching a missionary prep class. I know you're not thinking about going, but you might enjoy it. And I remember going, and after the first lesson, I thought to myself, what's the matter with these people? Why haven't they been encouraging me to go on a mission, for crying out loud? I need to do this. You know, I have been blessed with a couple of guys that found me. It's the least I can do to head out and try to find others. So as soon as I made that decision, once I joined the church, my business sort of started to go down a little bit. I was receiving less work, and my truck, you know, went out on me. I needed a new engine. As soon as I made that decision, all of a sudden, within several months, I had, you know, plenty of money to serve the mission and pay for it all myself. So that was another interesting event that occurred that first year as a member.
Wow. Encouraging stuff. That's great. And on your mission, I mean, did you, I guess I would assume your faith deepened, but at the same time that it was a struggle at moments, as it is for most missionaries?
I think the fact that I was older and I'd lived by myself made it easy for me. Now, you know, physically, everybody was sick. in Bolivia, you know, we were all eating for thousands, millions. You know, I had whipworm, roundworm, salmonella poisoning, maybe dysentery, typhoid, you know, so I tested positive for tuberculosis when I got home. So it's, in that respect, I guess it's a difficult mission, but you know, when you're in it, you don't think about it too much.
Yeah.
You know, people would see pictures of me that I would send home, and I looked emaciated. They were sending me dehydration formulas and very concerned about my health. And I'm walking around thinking, this is the most awesome experience to be here in Bolivia, sharing the gospel with people. I never had a moment where I wasn't happy to be there. I never had a moment where I doubted why I was there. I know a lot of young men when they leave, you know, at 18 or 19, they get there and they've really got to do some self-discovery. But remember, I was older and I had that event. And I was incredibly grateful. And I felt like I got to do this. And for me, it was an adventure. I mean, Bolivia is, you know, if you want an Indiana Jones experience, Bolivia is the place to be. It is it is primitive.
Wow.
And enough danger and strangeness to it that it's always exciting. So I never had a moment in my mission where I wasn't glad to be there.
That's great. And so you have an iron stomach and your immune system has nothing can beat it at this point.
I don't know. Or I'm going to die young because of it. I have no idea. Yeah. I guess we'll find out.
Right. Well, you'll find out for sure. Just some fun questions to get to know you further. Who's the most famous Mormon you've ever met? I hope it's not me, Steve, because I'm not that famous.
It may be you. I'm trying to remember if I've ever met anybody famous. You know, I live under the radar. You know, I just don't recall ever meeting anybody. Oh, okay. You know, I was thinking of church leaders. So I went to law school with Steve Young.
Oh, nice.
Now, a lot of people went to law school with Steve Young because he took 6 years to get through it.
Right. And he did it in the off season, right?
Yeah.
I read his book about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was there for 6 years. Huh. Funny story. I remember he and I, you know, we have these sort of mock trial exercises where you try to learn a little bit about courtroom events or at least what it's like. And so I'm sitting next to him. I'm the bailiff. I can't remember what role he was. And as the jury was coming in, there was this very pretty young woman who was walking in with the jury. And he turned to me and he said, "Steve, I think I see my wife." And I looked at her and I looked at him and I said, "You know, Steve, you should think family. Think family. Look at this lady down on the front row there." I said, "Now think family and look at her and think family." And he looked at me and he smiled and he goes, "I think I see what you mean. With your help, I should be married by the end of the semester." And of course he wasn't.
Right.
Much to the chagrin of all the young women who were in law school with him at the time.
But yeah.
He had a great sense of humor. He was very down to earth. And I know that he does a lot of good work through his foundation.
Yeah.
I would guess he's the most famous guy that I ever met.
Well, there it is. Even the most famous Mormon, right? Well, if you run into Steve at any law school reunions, we'd love to get him on the podcast and learn about his leadership he learned in the NFL. But that's for another day, I guess.
Yeah.
So what's the first general conference talk that comes to mind?
I think the one in 85 where Elder McConkie bore his testimony. And I remember that, not because that was the first one, but because that's the first one I saw after my mission. And I was with my wife, Janice, when I watched it. So I got home April 1st, March 31st, or whatever. I can't remember. It was that week. And wasted no time in driving up to Utah to hang out with Janice to get to know her better. And we watched conference together. And I remember that conference, Elder McConkie speaking and bearing his testimony.
Great. And from that moment of general conference, has any traditions formed in your family between you and your wife and your kids that happen every general conference?
Well, I don't know every general conference. You know, we have lots of traditions in our family. We have 8 kids, and there are varied traditions, you know, from a can of silly string in your stocking every Christmas, which is pretty wild when 10 cans of silly string are unloaded Christmas morning, to every Easter having a kind of Passover meal in our home. Huh. So where every dish is symbolic. You know, we have lamb, we have grape juice, we have olives, we have, you know, a bitter herb, usually a green onion. I make horoset, which is a combination of apples, walnuts, dates, and honey. And every dish on the table has some sort of significance or symbolism to it. We even say the prayer standing up. We leave an empty chair out at the beginning, reminding ourselves that the Jews are still waiting for Elisha to come, but we know he came, and then we put the chair away. We usually have one of the little kids go outside with their older sibling and put some red paper up on the doorposts. You know, it gets it's
wow, intense.
Yeah, well, it's fun though.
And a good educational experience.
Yeah, we eat and we invite the kids to talk about something on the table. Mm. How does it testify?
I like that. So what is, if you were to speak in general conference, what topic would you choose?
Well, you know, one of the most important concepts I've learned over the years is this idea of commitment pattern, where your morning prayer, you begin by committing to either do or not do something. and then you report back in the evening. I came upon this back, I think it was 91, 92. There was a priesthood lesson where there was a quote from Elder Kimball, President Kimball, about purifying your heart. And he said, categorize your sins, start with the most serious one, and commit every day and report back. And I think that's what he said. And I did that, and it's been very, very helpful. For instance, you know, I have 8 kids, my second child. But when he was about 5, I was shocked and horrified that he was acting like a 5-year-old. And so in response, I acted like a 5-year-old and was not always in control of my temper. And I decided I was going to pray every morning and commit. And I was not going to raise my voice to my son. And I noticed during the day that because I had made that commitment, when those moments arose where I might have otherwise lost my temper, I was reminded of my prayer. And it was as though I was able to step out of myself, see the situation, and rather than acting compulsively, make a choice. What was I going to do? And I'd stopped. And, you know, it's really amazing. If you do this and you screw up during the day, you know, you make a mistake, it doesn't take many evenings of reporting back and repenting for having broken your promise where you fix it. That concept I heard from Elder Bednar, I think about 5 or 6 years ago, and I can't remember the talk off the top of my head, but he mentioned that, and I hadn't taught it a lot. I mean, I taught it now and then, but I was a little concerned that I hadn't been hearing it, and then I heard it from him, and I gained more confidence, and so I have spoken about that when I get a chance, because I think it's such an important and useful tool for overcoming what I would consider compulsive problems. You know, if you don't pay your tithing, that's not a compulsive problem. That's an issue that requires changing your choices, right?
Yeah.
But from Häagen-Dazs ice cream to pornography to losing your temper, these are compulsive problems that people have that can be overcome. When I was bishop, I saw a lot of people use it, and we're grateful to have heard about it. And when Elder Bednar talked about it, I remember one of the leaders in our state coming to me and say, "Hey, just heard about that thing you've been talking about," and I was much relieved. So, but I think that's the most important thing, most important tool I've learned over the years.
Great. So, what leadership callings have you had? You know, whether they're official leadership callings or those that you would consider a leadership calling.
Well, I've been a bishop. I've been on the High Council twice. Interestingly enough, before I was called to be bishop, which was it's been about 10 years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I'd never presided over anything other than my own home. Hmm. So I'd been, for instance, a counselor in the Stake Men's Presidency, a counselor in the, you know, Stake Mission Presidency, you know, Stake Missionaries, you know. But I'd never really been an Elders Quorum President or anything like that before. So that was being a bishop was the first experience I had where I was actually presiding. Hmm.
So tell us, what do you remember from the experience of being called to serve as a bishop?
I remember, well, first of all, what had happened was, is we had 2 wards. One ward was not doing well in terms of attendance, and another ward was doing very well, and they were sort of adjacent to one another. And the stake president divided them both in half. And then joined half of each in one ward and half of each in another. And I remember when he announced that he was going to do that, getting this feeling that I might be called as a bishop. It's interesting how sometimes that happens to people. I'm not the only one. I understand that I've had that feeling. And I remember him calling me to be the bishop. And I thought, I've never presided over anything, but I've had enough callings to know that whatever it is, I can do it because God will help me. And I remember him giving me, you know, Handbook 1 and telling me to go home and read it, which I did, and getting to my first bishopric training meeting, which was not training at all. It was business. And I remember thinking, so that's the training. Read the book and pray about it.
Right.
And so, and that is so true in so many callings in the church. Here's the book, and even the book, if you look at Handbook 1, you know, that handbook governs the entire church, right? And the vast majority of it just basically says who's the one supposed to be praying about this. which I find really interesting, that the whole church is run by people praying about what they're supposed to do next. And mostly what we have is just a sort of a delegation of service. You know, you're bishop, you get to serve these people. You're a councilman, you serve these people. If you're elders, quorum president, you serve these people. If you're a Sunday school teacher, you serve these people. If you're a youth leader, you serve these people. And that's really all. That's kind of how it's laid out. It's very simple, but it works great.
Yeah. And where was this, where were you living at the time when you were called as bishop?
I was living in Tooele, Utah.
Oh, okay. Nice. And how would you describe the demographics of that ward?
Where I was bishop?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was unusual. Now, we had a large primary, so there were a lot of young couples. I think at one point we may have had 160 or 170 kids in primary.
Oh, okay.
It was wall-to-wall kids in there.
So pretty traditional Utah ward.
Yeah, we had a lot of youth as well. I remember there were 33 young women at girls' camp one summer from our ward. So we had a lot of kids.
Yeah.
A lot of kids and some elderly. I think it was just a good mix of people. You know, unlike some wards, which are what they call the newlywed and the nearly dead wards, you know, where you have
right.
elderly people. So
yeah. And other than, you know, the youth and the high level of children in the ward, any other uniqueness about that ward that impacted your calling as bishop?
You know, everywhere I go, there are great people working really hard to serve. And I think, you know, when you're a member and you're just doing your calling and focusing on your responsibility, you don't see the whole picture. And as a bishop, to attend ward council and see how hard people worked, you know, from the primary president to the elders' quorum president to the high priest group leader, I mean, I was just so humbled by how hard people worked and how they wanted to do well. And they loved the kids. They loved the members. They loved, you know, the Relief Society loved, the president loved everybody. And I just, for me, that's the thing that was so special about being a bishop was that. And the other thing was, I remember when I was called, the last thing I wanted to do was learn about the problems that people were facing. I liked living in my bubble, thinking everybody was happy, that nobody was struggling. And I remember as I was about to be set apart, one of the bishops in the other wards told me, he said, you know, there's a real upside to this calling. Watch for it. And I remember learning that, seeing the atonement in action, watching people come to my office who were burdened with sin and watching them leave happy turned out to be the best thing about being a bishop. It was the thing I wasn't looking forward to, and it was the thing that I loved the most.
Yeah.
Just seeing people feel better. And it's an interesting concept that you just take a neighbor, you call him bishop, and if you'll go in and talk to him about it, you'll feel better. It's the strangest thing. But that's what we do. And it
works. That is. And thankfully there's power that's involved there and keys, nonetheless that further confirms to me, you know, of the power and validity of those, of that priesthood and those keys, because at the end of the day, it's just one neighbor that we call bishop, you know, and so there's got to be more there.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that, you know, you don't go to school to be a bishop. I was handed a manual and told to go read it. And yet, when you're set apart and you become the bishop, things happen. I mean, you know, you're given things. Now you know how to help this person. It's the strangest thing. It's really awesome.
And as we do on these How I Lead interviews, is I've had you just think through and prepare five leadership principles that you either learned or used in your time as in your leadership service. And so let's go through these and have you expound on them and see what we can learn. The first one you put is assume the best in those you are serving.
Yeah. Let me give you an example. In Grantsville, I was a choir director. Interestingly enough, we also had an orchestra, which is another story in itself. When we left Grantsville, I had 10 violins, 6 violas, 4 cellos, an upright bass, and a smattering of woodwinds. And
Wait a minute. So this is, you had this like every time your choir performed, you had an orchestra?
About 5 times a year. And on Christmas, we would have 3 numbers prepared.
Wow.
To accompany the choir or a soloist. And I also, there was, some of those kids would perform in the stake orchestra as well, which was mostly youth, some adults. And I remember some of the kids, when you first meet them, and this applies to all callings with kids, teenagers, there's some of them that they're the cool teen. They have this sort of bored look on their face. They're almost afraid to be cheerful, to risk, right? I guess what it is. But boy, when you get to know them, they're just so awesome. I've had that experience over and over again to the point where when I see the cool team, it doesn't look like a challenge to me because I know underneath that cool exterior is someone who's just awesome. And I can't wait to get to know them. So I've had that experience over and over with the youth. And so you want to assume the best, and you don't want to assume that people aren't interested, that they don't want to help, they don't enjoy it, because they usually do.
Nice. And I think that principle leads into the next one, which is remember every person has a unique perspective. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, my calling now is a family history consultant coordinator. So my job is to train the family history consultants and coordinate their activities in our ward. And I occasionally will meet with some of the youth, you know, because most of the consultants are youth. They're the ones that can navigate the programs really well. They're really good with computers. And have on occasion had some of the youth over to my home, and I want to teach them something, you know, because I think I know what I'm doing, right? I've got it figured out. And I'll sit down and they'll just be zipping around the website, and they're not really interested in learning anything right now. They're just really excited about showing me what they do. Mm. And one particular youth, I thought to myself, as I was working with her, I thought, I would really like to help her do this or that, but she loves this. She has her own approach, her own way of looking at things. And I don't want to mess that up by suggesting that maybe she needs to change what she's doing in terms of how she's solving problems, how she's searching, what she's looking for. And so, you know, when I'm training or trying to help somebody, I always want to remember that they have their own ideas. And if I can help them improve, great. But the last thing I want to do is damper their enthusiasm or make them feel like they're inadequate.
Yeah.
That's just one example.
That's great. And your third principle is every person has something to offer. So avoid controlling the event so closely that you fail to learn from them. I'm intrigued by this, Steve. Expound on that.
So I've had this happen many times, you know, teaching gospel doctrine, for instance. You know, you'll be teaching a topic and you've got the material, you know where you want to go, you know how you want the class to go, you know what you want to share. And someone will make a comment that appears to have absolutely nothing with what you're talking to do with what you're talking about. And it's an area that you just don't know what they're getting at. Yeah. And I've seen it happen where the instructor will say, oh, okay. And then they'll go to another person. And I think the person that made that comment must be feeling as though their comment was of no value. And I've learned over the years that they said that for a reason. I mean, here's a person who was brave enough to raise their hand and say something in class that they thought was important. There's something there. And so when that happens, I have learned to say, if I have no idea what they're talking about, say, tell me more about that. And maybe do some follow-up questions so that I understand what they're getting at. And every time, it ends up being a really interesting approach to the doctrine or to that situation that we're talking about. And it's usually just because they didn't express it the way they had hoped to, or they were looking at it from their unique perspective, right? And they knew all the details surrounding their comment, and I didn't. No one else in the class did either, apparently. And at least that's what I was thinking. But then once I started peeling back the onion, you could see, that's how that applies.
Yeah. And yeah, so, it's easy to assume that what they're saying has no relation to the lesson plan or the topic, but the more you create space to help them explain and expound, then you get there, and it's usually a valuable perspective.
Yeah, and the great thing is next time they'll want to participate. And one of the things that all teachers crave is class participation. And the way to encourage that is give people some space and assume that they've got something to offer.
Yeah. All right, the fourth leadership principle you put is remember that whatever the event, it is supposed to be joyful.
Yeah, serving should not be stressful, and it's easy to say.
Right.
And I think for a lot of the men, it's not stressful. Maybe it is. Everybody wants to be well thought of. Everybody wants to, if they're given an assignment, they want everybody to think, wow, that was great. That was a great lesson. That was a great event that you put together. Boy, you really decorated the cultural hall well for that Christmas party. And so often people feel a lot of stress because they want it to go well and they want to do well and they want to be loved and appreciated and even admired for their abilities. And I think it's counterproductive to be stressful. If you can have fun doing what you're doing, even if it's not perfect, it's going to be more enjoyable for everybody around you. When I was, you know, running this orchestra in my ward out in Grantsville, you know, we would have kids come to the rehearsals. We'd be working on things, and I would remind them, remember, this is supposed to be fun, you know, as we're rehearsing and working on things, you know, and they would all laugh, and we'd remember, right, that this is supposed to be fun. And it was, you know, when you're well prepared and the kids play well, and it's inspiring to the members of the ward. And I often tell the kids, well, the way you feel about what you're playing can be felt by other members in the audience. I want you to think about the lyrics, think about this music as you're playing it on your violin, your viola, your cello, your bass, whatever. Think about this tune as you're playing it. Isn't it awesome? And if you play and you feel that way, that's how they'll feel. And so whatever you're doing, even laying sod, it needs to be fun.
Yeah. And that's I think that's a good advice for most leaders to hear, because if in general you're not having fun, or, you know, you're it makes me think of a few weeks ago, a wife put online one of these videos where, you know, someone's coming out of anesthesia or being woken up from a surgery, and, you know, they say all sorts of crazy things. And this individual was LDS and complaining about how much he hates PAC meeting and his role as a scout leader. Right. And so I think we all underneath the surface, sometimes we feel like, you know, I'm supposed to do this, but this has sort of been a drag lately, or I'm not enjoying it as much. And so to sort of step back and say, am I really enjoying this? And if not, how can I fix that? Which leads into your fifth principle if you are not loving those you serve, review steps 1 through 4. And to me, that your principles here, they're all focused around relationships with individuals that you're serving, at least how I'm reading it, right? And so to get back to that core, you really have to connect with individuals that you're leading.
Yeah, and you know, there's some callings, so maybe PAC meeting isn't the funnest thing for everybody. But I mean, if you step back for a minute, what is PAC meeting? It's a time to get together with a bunch of silly boys and be silly, isn't it?
Yeah.
And congratulate them on working hard and inspire them to work harder, and to remind them that this is supposed to be fun. And let me tell you what we're doing next week, and it's going to be awesome. You know, if that's the approach, then wouldn't it be great if it was really that way?
Yeah. Strong principle for sure. Well, Steve, this has been fantastic. A lot of good principles, and to hear about your conversion story. I mean, all beneficial, good time spent. And I'm just intrigued by this orchestra. Was this your idea, or is this something that had been going on prior to you being bishop? Or?
No, it's a funny thing the way it happened. You know, as you know, I'm a musician. Uh-huh. When I was young, I did a lot of it, and I was a jazz musician. So jazz musicians, we do a lot of transcribing, meaning we listen to a piece and we write it down. So one day, I had just been in the ward. We'd moved to Grantsville, been there a few months, and maybe 6 months. And one of the sisters in the ward came up to me and said, the bishop would like for the young people in the ward who play, and we had about 4 or 5 that we knew of, a couple of violins, a viola, a couple of cellos. He would like them to have a chance to play together once. Now, people that ask that question don't realize that there just isn't a lot of music out there for that particular instrumentation for kids at that level, or kids at different levels. I mean, there were kids that were just learning, and there were kids that were really good, and there was one adult who was really good. And so I said, okay, let me see what I can find. And we worked with this little group of 4 or 5 kids, and my daughter, at the time, who plays the harp, she was going to play the piano part on the piece, and it was O Divine Redeemer, Charles Gounod piece. And so we got that ready, and it took a few months, you know, because some of the kids just needed extra help, you know. And we played in sacrament meeting, and everybody just thought that was so neat to have this little, you know, string quintet and with harp accompaniment. It was so well done. And then I was asked to be choir director and incorporate some of these instruments in the choir. And so for Christmas, I decided, well, let's do a few more tunes than just one. Let's do 3. We'll have a narrator, and I'll borrow some kids from another ward. And we had, I think, 5 violins, 2 violas, and a cello with a piano and the choir. And everybody just had a great time. And for some reason, that inspired a bunch of kids in the ward to want to learn to play string instruments. And I remember one of the parents came up to me and said that my son has asked me if he can learn to play the violin. His goal is to be able to play in the ward orchestra. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I hope I can get him there because he's just learning. So what I would do is I would have sectionals during the week. I would have, you know, maybe the second violins or the violas come over. Those are the ones that have these really hard to hear internal parts by themselves. They don't sound like anything, you know, they don't sound like anybody. And it's hard for a kid to hear if they're playing in tune. So I would have them come over and I would play their part on the piano while we're playing along with the recording of the music. You know, we might be doing Be Still My Soul, which is a Mack Wilbrick arrangement. And I would transcribe the music for the kids. So I would listen to that and write it down. And I would play the part, their part, along with the recording so they could hear their part in context and we work on intonation. And as we did this, it just got more and more out of hand. We were asked, I was asked if I could if I could do the state choir for state conference one time. And one performance we had one day in our ward was Be Still My Soul, as I recall. And so I invited some other kids from the stake and some other adults to come and join us. And so we accompanied the state choir with this stake orchestra for the, we did two musical numbers and I arranged the music. And it just got to be more and more and more kids wanted to do it. And pretty soon the stake youth orchestra is playing for Standards Night. And we're doing four or five performances during the year in the ward. And then we did a music videos where, for instance, every year, every year the youth has a theme, right? It would be embark upon the service of the Lord and or whatever, right? And there'd be this tune that is produced and that you can download it. And I would transcribe that song. And then the youth would come to my home where I set up a little recording studio downstairs in the basement. And I would have one of the guys in the stake who was a pretty good photographer and could do some editing. He would come over and videotape the kids as we were recording. So you've got, you know, these kids playing the violin with their headphones on, you know, and you've got maybe a piano player with their headphones on. I would have them come in at different times to record a piece. And like Embark, we would intersperse in the music video shots of the kids recording the piece or singing the piece with kids doing service project during the spring and fall. And then we would play that video at Standards Night. And
that's great.
It's on YouTube. So I think I've got three or four different music videos we did with the kids on YouTube right now.
Yeah. Love to link to those so that if youth leaders need an idea or whatever it is, that's great inspiration to have.
And that's some of the fun things we did. And like I said, it just got out of hand to where we had lots of kids wanting to learn string instruments and I was trying to help them, you know, with their intonation. That's the hardest thing for young players.
Wow. If a choir director doesn't know how to magnify his calling, he can listen to this and there's one idea. So that's great. Well, Steve, this is fantastic. I'm excited to check out those videos. And like I said, I'll link to them and appreciate all the principles and thought that you've put into this. And the last question I have is, as you think back, especially your time serving as bishop, how has serving as a leader made you a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
I think it's made me more grateful for everything, the people that work hard, for the atonement. And I think that gratitude is really the key to happiness. Count your many blessings. We sing that for a reason, because we have a lot to be grateful for, not just the atonement, to have been dropped here at this time in Lehigh, my goodness, in America. The church is on the earth. The priesthood can be in the home. It's a lot to be grateful for. And I think when you're grateful, you're happier. And when you're happier, you just serve better.
All right, we learned from Steve today that we need to go out and start an orchestra. Great way to engage the youth in the ward. I thought that was fascinating, you know, creating some type of culture or initiative in your wards or stakes or quorum, whatever it is, that intrigues people and helps people want to be a part of that. I think that's exactly what this orchestra did. But nonetheless, a big shout out to Steve for being a part of this. Great leadership principles, and I hope you took note, and I hope you're inspired to, you know, love those that you serve and find joy in these callings and these leadership callings that can sometimes be a drag, but they shouldn't be a drag. It just means we have opportunity to step back and find the joy, the simple joy in these leadership callings. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, if you know of somebody who would be a great fit for the How I Lead segment, again, I'm always striving to get more and more sisters on the podcast, but nonetheless, if there's a great brother out there that has inspired you by their leadership style, I would love to talk with them and learn from their experience. Also, you know, from time to time, I hear of or a ward that's, you know, done a challenge among their youth or the general membership. And I would love to share those types of stories. They can be very short podcasts and we can just hear, you know, this is what we did for one activity and it kind of exploded and we had this great family history event or whatever it is, and talking about those details, because then other leaders can hear them and say, man, I'm going to try that. As always, all we ask is that you contribute to Leading LDS, and you can do that by going to leadinglds.org, and there's a big donate button there on the homepage, and there you can contribute whatever amount is affordable to you. I'm not looking for you to put your family under stress by what you donate to Leading LDS, but all of us, if you're benefiting from the content that we produce at Leading LDS, we need your help, and we ask that you contribute. So go to leadinglds.org and contribute. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.